Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The EU continues to look the other way, and those who look the other way are as responsible for the egregious crimes of occupation against Palestinians as those who carry them out, says David Hurst Ryder in an article titled EU's Shameless Complicity in Israeli Regime's Crimes. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. The Zionist regime works actively day and night to crush all forms of resistance and bury the dream of a Palestinian state. 2 months after Palestinians rose to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque and contest the evictions in occupied East Al-Quds, the conflict barely registers on the world stage. Media coverage is sporadic and selective. It's all quiet on the Western Front. The Zionist regime's new foreign minister, Yair Lapid, has once more become the acceptable face of Israeli rejectionism. Delivering the same message as his predecessors, Lapid was given a quiet ride at the Foreign Affairs Council, the EU's chief foreign policy body, in Brussels recently. He felt comfortable telling the EU that there was no possibility of a Palestinian state. So at ease was that? He wagged his finger at his European audience. There is one thing we need to remember. If there will be a Palestinian state, it needs to be a peace-seeking democracy. You cannot ask us to build with our own hands another threat to our lives, said Lapid. No one in the council challenged him. No one reminded Lapid of what the Israeli regime is doing actively day and night to tear down Palestinian homes with their own hands and bury a Palestinian state. The following is a brief and almost certainly incomplete list of what happens in Palestine when nothing happens. On June 11th, two Palestinian boys were shot in weekly protest in Beita near Nablus at the appearance of an illegal settlement on the hilltop above the village of Avatar. Under an agreement, the settlers accepted to leave, but their huts and the army base remain. Mohammed Said Hamayel, aged 15, was shot. When the villagers tried to evacuate the wounded boy, they were shot. By the time they reached his body, he was dead, according to eyewitnesses. A second boy from the same clan, Muhammad Naif Hamayel, was shot and wounded. These were not clean wounds. The internal damage the boy received was immense. His spleen was seriously damaged because of the bullets the Israelis use, which fragment and turn inside the body. A total of 4 Palestinians from Beita were killed in demonstrations. On June 29th, a butchery in Albustan Silvan was demolished, the first of 20 units that received demolition orders on June 7th. The Israeli regime police fired rubber-coated bullets to disperse a crowd aiming to protect their homes. On July 3rd, Mohammad Hassan, aged 21, was finishing work on his house in Ghusra when it was attacked by dozens of armed settlers. They were attempting to break into the house. A group of troops arrived to surround the house while the settler attack continued. Hassan locked the doors and went to the rooftop. There, he threw stones to fend off the attack. He was shot dead by the troops. Palestinian medics and ambulances were unable to reach his body. On July 7th, the Zionist regime civil administration returned to the Palestinian herding community of Homsa in the Jordan Valley, accompanied by the military. According to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, they demolished 27 residential and animal structures and water tanks. They took all the food and milk for the children, including their nappies and toys. 11 households comprising dozens of people were left in the desert. Temperatures ranged from 37 to 42 degrees Celsius during the eviction period. While this was happening, the Knesset was debating the citizenship and entry law, which bars almost 45,000 Palestinian families inside the occupied territories and occupied Ishtarots from uniting with their spouses and children. Without Israeli documents, these people have no health insurance or COVID-19 jabs and cannot travel. The law failed to be renewed, but according to Israeli press reports, every application submitted by Palestinian families will be faced by the automatic rejection of Interior Minister Ayelet Shaked.
Weight of Chains. Part 3.
In a few cases, however, the Hague Tribunal did manage to bring an indictment against Kosovo Albanians who were accused of committing crimes, like in the case of Ramush Haradinaj. Don't let the glasses fool you. Haradinaj was one ruthless KLA militant in the 1990s, accused of murdering Serbs, Roma, and even non-compliant Albanians during the Kosovo War.
We had a lot of difficulties to come to an end to the investigation against Haradinaj. But at the end, we achieved it. So we could issue an indictment against him, and this indictment was confirmed by a judge.
However, as the trial started and progressed, something strange happened.
Haradinaj was freed of all charge because a number of witnesses were killed. According to former Hague Tribunal prosecutor Khaled Ponte, 9 witnesses were killed between 2003 and 2007. So in such a situation, living witnesses are frightened and some of them refuse to testify, others change their testimony. The UN mission in Kosovo always refused to cooperate with the Hague Tribunal by refusing to send evidence of war crime.
It is understandable that NATO didn't want their KLA buddies in jail, but the largest single act of ethnic cleansing during the Yugoslav wars, Operation Storm, in which Croat forces ethnically cleansed 250,000 Serbs from the Krajina region in Croatia, with thousands killed in cold blood, was perhaps the biggest test for the tribunal. General Ante Gotovina was in charge of that operation, and the Hague Tribunal put up an indictment. Gotovina was arrested and tried and, believe it or not, convicted.
First instance trial, he was convicted 23 years. So, evidences were there. Enough evidences to convict and to sentence him.
However, another strange thing happened here. The case quickly went to appeal, the previous sentence was overturned, and Gotovina was immediately released.
It was extremely damaging to Serbs in this case, you know. And killing in Operation Storm, they obliged the Serbs to leave Knin and so on and so on. So we prove it. In the first instance, the Gotovina was convicted. So why now on appeal this completely different decision?
You think it was more of a political decision?
You say it, and I must say yes, because I cannot believe it.
Ante Gotovina was given a hero's welcome in Croatia. But not all Croats believed in the Gotovina myth. This war profiteer, however, was a free man, with the blessing of the West. He played an important part in what the West really wanted. And when a nation has war profiteers as heroes, it's no wonder that as the fighting subsides, the system remains corrupt. Ivo Sanader ruled as Prime Minister of Croatia from 2003 to 2009, and under the mask of being a European Union-friendly statesman, bought people left and right. According to the Washington Times, Sanader turned Croatia into a gangster country, and by controlling most of the media, including state television and leading Croatian newspapers, he could make sure that the people only saw things his way. During his rule, Sanader amassed enormous wealth, that included illegally acquired property, luxurious villas, and a lavish collection of watches worth over $200,000. After 6 years in power, Sanader decided to step down. Eventually, Sanader was arrested, put on trial, and sentenced to 10 years for his wrongdoings. However, the system remained corrupt, and the people of the former Yugoslavia could only hope that an honest, hard-working man would show up and fight against systemic corruption. He came in the form of a TV morning talk show guest. Ljubiša Milanović was appointed by former Serbian Health Minister Zoran Stanković to his anti-corruption division. He was the first state official to openly criticize the police, state prosecutors, and anti-corruption agency, claiming that they just weren't interested in helping him fight corruption. Yes, the cartoon never ended, but Milanović's position did. He quickly got sacked by Health Minister Stanković after these statements on state television. Fortunately, the Serbian political elite took these warnings seriously and decided to act decisively. That's what the people love to watch. They've been conditioned by the media to look the other way when it came to matters of urgency that could really affect their lives. Considering what the new guys after Milosevic did to the education system, it made some sense.
Former Yugoslavia had an excellent educational system. I'm product of that system, so most of the people from those years, my colleagues, are all over the world and they're extremely successful. However, what happened after 2001, they simply assumed that whatever was suggested by European Union, they have to implement it regardless of consequences.
In 2001, Jasmina Vujic, a professor at Berkeley University, the first woman to become dean of the Department of Nuclear Engineering in the United States, suggested to the then Minister of Education, Gaša Knežević, and his associate professor, Srbijan Katurajlić, that before they attempt any reforms, they should invite professors from the diaspora, who worked in all kinds of education systems, and form the best one for Serbia. There was no reply. The reforms went on as planned.
Bottom line is that students of today are learning 10% of what we learned in the previous system. So they are producing new generations of students that will be poorly educated, particularly in terms of higher education in my field, such as electrical engineering or mechanical engineering and so on.
Yes, the education system made no sense, and no one had the guts to fix it. After all, a good education system would lead to a smart populace. And which government in their right mind would want a free-thinking society that could critically analyze what that same government was doing? Things weren't any better for cultural workers or artists. Culture and art simply weren't on the radar for many people. The most interesting story I heard was when independent filmmaker Branko Radaković, who was making his documentary Culture is Blooming, asked a guy in the Serbian town of Paracin about his thoughts on culture.
Somebody was too honest in front of the camera.
The guy still wanted the clip removed. Branko refused. Since the government didn't waste time on irrelevant tasks such as creating a civilized populace, the media used their power to popularize shows that educated and enlightened the people on what really mattered.
You use the term democracy, its presence or its absence, strictly for politics.
The United States has a pretty good record, I think, over the centuries of helping move countries toward democracy.
In fact, the United States instituted regime change wherever democracy resulted in a leader who was not favorable to Western economic interests.
Any country or political movement that tries to use the land, the labor, the capital, the markets of that country in a way outside of this global imperial system will be designated as an enemy, as an aggressor, as an oppressor, as a danger to the American people, and therefore we have to attack them.
It was also important to make the American people afraid of the proclaimed enemy.
I was raised, my whole generation, it was the communists. Communists here, communists everywhere. Communists going to get your mama, you know?
You are the target of those who would trample the liberties of free men. You are in the crosshairs of the bomb sight an enemy is centering on you.
Now the communists are gone, and that became a crisis for a while. They had to find another demon who is a threat and frightens the people enough, and now it's the terrorists.
Since the end of the Cold War in 1991, the end of communism, the United States has behaved very badly as a sole superpower. It has tried to dominate the world completely.
Your country has to be thrown open. It has to be a satellite for us. The empire sees two kinds of nations out there. One is satellites, or client states, they're called, and the other is potential enemy. Iraq is a very special, interesting case, because you saw both of those things happening with the very same leader, Saddam Hussein. When he was murdering everybody on the left, when he destroyed the Iraqi democracy, Washington loved him. They loved him. They sent him aid. They took pictures with him, and he was their poster boy. And then when he turned around and started insisting on a better deal on the oil quotas, he didn't go toward the free market, and he committed economic nationalism. Then they suddenly started saying, oh, Saddam Hussein, he's worse than Hitler.
It seemed very dangerous to support policies the U.S. didn't like, and it didn't matter whether you were a dictator or a Democrat. Hugo Chavez was democratically elected in Venezuela in 1998, promising to stand up to the United States. Many thought he wouldn't last long. His first task was to change the 1961 constitution that was drawn up by the neoliberal elites.
This constitution was making for them, for their benefit, not for the benefit of the people. Who promised the people in 1998 in the campaign to do that? And in 1999, who make a new constitution? In our constitution, in the first article, we change our foreign policy. Our policy will be based in three important things: cooperation, complementation, and solidarity.
What this meant in practice was soon noticeable.
In 2001, when in Argentina was a very difficult economy situation, no, the first country and the only country helped Argentina was Venezuela, was Chavez. Cristina all the time said that. Chavez tell her, you have no dollars, you have coal, you have meat, and we have oil. We give you oil. You can pay oil with coal, with meat. It is not necessary to use dollars.
Wait, working together on exchanging products they produce? Not bickering amongst each other? Not importing U.S. products? Not using the dollar? Blasphemy.
He announced that Venezuela would pull out of both the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And his government took control of the last remaining privately run oil fields.
Chavez only practiced state socialism that used to be practiced in Yugoslavia. But for this Chavez became an enemy of the United States.
Hugo Chavez is a dictator.
The world's worst dictators. Hugo Chavez.
A dictator.
A dictator.
Anti-democratic despot.
Tyrant with a radical agenda.
Crushing free people.
There is such a thing as a killer clown, and he may be it.
In 15 years, we have 19 elections. 19. And we only didn't win in one. We won 18 elections, 18. And all the time say that Chavez is a dictator. And now they are saying that Maduro is a dictator.
The media were playing an important role for what was being prepared for Chavez. It was 2002, and for the CIA, everything was going as planned.
In the end, this is what triggered the overthrow of Hugo Chavez. Armed gangs loyal to the Venezuelan president firing on thousands of anti-government protesters. After 16 people were killed and hundreds wounded, last night soldiers surrounded the presidential palace.
Even though it was never established who fired at both pro-Chavez and anti-Chavez demonstrators, Chavez was taken to prison. Another democratically elected leader was replaced by a dictator, Venezuelan Federation of Chambers of Commerce President Pedro Carmona, a pro-business elites leader who quickly dissolved the National Assembly and Supreme Court and declared the Constitution void. While the United States were cheering on the real dictator, Carmona, something unexpected happened. People started pouring into the streets. A pro-Chavez popular uprising was becoming unstoppable.
The power of the people in the street. We go to the street, and in front of us was the military. We are not afraid. We go on, no? And we ask that we want our president. We want our president back.
The pro-Chavez presidential guard took back the presidential palace and reinstalled Chavez as president. The coup d'etat failed. In spite of huge CIA support and almost all of the Venezuelan media also supporting the coup. When Chavez came to power, 80% of the country was classified as poor.
Now our poor people is less than 20%.
At the beginning of Chavez's rule, 45% were extremely poor.
So now very, very poor is 5.6%. It's the first time in the history of Venezuela that 65% of the money we get about the oil are using for increase the level of living of the people.
Perhaps Chavez had some good ideas, and his ideas spread throughout Latin America. A continent away, a country was feeling the shackles of debt, and many people simply didn't understand why it paralyzed the country.
The so-called sovereign foreign debt of Greece was created and accumulated by the policies of the governments, which were doing neoliberal policies, by the way, taking loans from the international markets, giving cheap loans to entrepreneurs and to enterprises, which were then taking the money out to Switzerland or to the Cayman Islands and so on, without investing them, without creating growth, without creating giving jobs within the capitalist system.
What a fine system it was.
The debt have not been created by the peoples, neither in the case of Greece nor in the case of Portugal or Ireland.
But the people were the ones who were supposed to pay the price. This is why the people of many countries facing this problem went to the streets to demand justice. Many of these countries had already repaid their debts several times over, but because of the interest rates, they were condemned to a never-ending vicious cycle of debt payments. However, one president decided that when it came to his country paying off these debts, enough was enough.
Ecuador refused paying the debt after Rafael Correa came to power, who was second and third time re-elected, and he said, no, we have paid it already.
President Correa's the man. He declared his country's debt illegitimate and said that Ecuador would default on over $3 billion worth of bonds. He pledged to fight the creditors in international courts and actually succeeded, reducing the price of outstanding bonds by over 60%.
If the loans are given, this means to make profit, to make business actually through the poor countries which are in debt, then there is also legally by international law a basis to claim that you cannot pay back after 10 years paying. You have paid it already two times. For that, you need the willing governments, which will confront the powerful banks and the IMF and so on.
President Correa reduced Ecuador's poverty, indigence, and unemployment,
and he could do this because he had the people behind him. But another reason why some countries were successful in rebelling against Western control is also because they had a strong military. Yugoslavia had the fourth largest military in Europe, and while it was united, no one dared to attack it militarily at the time. A source from Serbia's military security agency that asked to remain anonymous told me just how ready Serbia was to defend itself against an external enemy. This comes as no surprise. Boris Tadic, who was among the first to hold the post of Minister of Defense of Serbia and Montenegro after Milosevic fell, later becoming President of Serbia in two terms, prided himself on his achievements in regards to the military. Though they were called experts by the government, pushing Serbia's military towards so-called NATO standards was top priority. When someone starts shooting at you, your English proficiency and computer skills might not be enough to protect yourself. Military analyst Miroslav Lazanski explained on Serbian national television why the military was unable to adequately protect the country from wide-scale flooding that took place in 2014. As the people were becoming aware that Western-imposed reforms weren't in the interest of ordinary citizens, the West had to make sure that the people, their leaders, and the media would stay in line. To do this, the West continued funding certain non-governmental organizations.
It's very funny because a lot of these non-governmental organizations are governmental. They're financed by the United States government.
The NGOs that had the most political and media influence in Serbia were the Humanitarian Law Center, officially led by Sandra Orlovic, who succeeded Nataša Kandić, the Center for Cultural Decontamination, led by Borka Pavicevic, the Helsinki Board for Human Rights, led by Sonja Biserko, the Youth Initiative for Human Rights, led by Maja Micic, and the Center for Euro-Atlantic Studies, led by Jelena Milic. Most of these NGOs operated in other republics of the former Yugoslavia as well, but the Serbian representatives were the most interesting.
Serbian public, they immediately discard us and discharge us as paid by NATO.
But where does the center receive its funding?
From Open Society Fund in Belgrade, from National Endowment for Democracy, from Rockefeller Brothers Foundation.
National Endowment for Democracy, Rockefeller Brothers.
For two events, from NATO Public Diplomacy, but it was not enough.
So you are paid by NATO, in a way.
For two events.
From the beginning, when we were formed, it was support from Swedish Helsinki Committee, and it's called, now it's Fund for Open Society, and it is a solid foundation.
And some governments like Norway, which is very present in the region, not only helping NGOs, but also state.
The Norwegian People Aid built us a roof, because it was ruined here where we are. Look at this, it looks like that.
And then through different humanitarian programs and so on.
What Ms. Kandić didn't want to say is that her Humanitarian Law Center was directly funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, the Open Society Foundation, USAID, the United States Institute of Peace, the Balkan Trust for Democracy, Civil Rights Defenders, the King Bodin Foundation, and then there's also the European Commission, the OSCE Mission to Serbia, the British Embassy in Belgrade, the Austrian Development Cooperation, the Canadian Embassy in Belgrade, the German Embassy in Belgrade, the Royal Netherlands Embassy in Belgrade, the Swiss Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and 10 other foreign organizations. At the end of the day, whose interest is Ms. Kandić looking after? The citizens of Serbia, who largely dislike her work, or all these foreign governments and organizations, which give her money? But the foreign financiers don't stop with the NGOs that I mentioned. Some also fund UKOM Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, Women in Black, Peščanik or Hourglass, Sanja Committee for the Protection of Human Rights and Freedoms, Civic Initiatives, and many others. Don't let the whole human rights mantra fool you. This is especially interesting considering that Borka Pavicevic's Center for Cultural Decontamination received $38,000 in 2013 from the National Endowment for Democracy to promote public debate on various issues.
Does everybody have the right to a different opinion?
Some NGO members were also members of political parties at the same time, like Dušan Gamser, who was an economic advisor at the Center for Euro-Atlantic Studies, as well as the international secretary of the Liberal Democratic Party.
So you're a member of a political party and you work at an NGO?
Yes, yes, why not?
You don't think there's a conflict of interest?
No, I don't.
Why not?
Yeah, these are different things. In political party, you are helping your party colleagues to get to power. You are advising them. You do things, various things in the party. And when you are in the NGO, you do things, maybe same things, by other methods.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Trainings for the Colombian mercenaries accused of killing Haitian President Moa were conducted in both the U.S. and Colombia, some as recently as 2015, says Ryan Dovaro Ryder in an article titled, At Least 7 Colombians in Haiti Assassination Received U.S. Training. Stay tuned for more. More than a quarter of the ex-Colombian soldiers currently suspected in the assassination of Haitian President Moa received U.S. military training, The Intercept confirmed recently, with some of the alleged attackers participating in programs as recently as 2015 that ranged from vehicle maintenance and professional development to counterterrorism and drug war operations. Courses were held in both Colombia and the United States. The Pentagon and the State Department are currently reviewing internal records to determine precisely how many of the alleged assassins were trained by the U.S. To date, State and DOD have identified 7 individuals among a possible 25 alleged to have been involved by Haitian authorities that previously participated in past U.S. military training and education programs while previously serving in Colombian military. A U.S. government official confirmed in an email to The Intercept. Individuals had been approved for a variety of training activities held both in Colombia and the United States between 2001 to 2015. Recently, the Pentagon confirmed to the Washington Post that a smaller number of the Colombian mercenaries suspected In the July 7 assassination had received U.S. training, though the department did not say how many or when, nor what type of training was provided. According to the official who spoke to The Intercept, examples of the types of training received were various types of military leadership and professional development training, emergency medical training, helicopter maintenance, and attendance at seminars on counter-narcotics and counterterrorism. From 2000, when the United States first launched the massive multi-billion-dollar war aid program known as Plan Colombia to 2018, the U.S. administered more than 107,640 trainings of Colombian security personnel, noted Adam Isaskun, director of the Defense Oversight Program at the Washington Office on Latin America, a figure that far surpasses any other military collaboration the U.S. maintains in the region. Nothing comes close to 107,000 over the last 20 years, Isaskun told The Intercept. Nothing, he added. 18 former Colombian soldiers are currently being held in Haiti in connection with Moa's assassination, including some who previously served in elite Colombian Special Operations Unit. New details on their involvement in the assassination continue to break by the day. Recently, the Colombian news magazine Semana reported that one of the former troops confessed that the mercenary team was responsible for the assassination and that the killing was orchestrated by an inner circle of seven mercenaries within the larger group. The magazine reported that investigators had also recovered surveillance footage of the attack. Family members of many of the detained Colombians have said that their loved ones believed they were being hired to provide personal security for a VIP in Haiti and that they did not sign on to participate in an assassination. Speaking to reporters recently, Colombian President Iván Duque said that regardless of individual levels of insight into the operation's true intent, all would be held responsible for Moa's killing. To Isaskun, little about the kind of training the alleged assassins experienced with the U.S. military stood out as particularly unique given the long-standing relationship between the U.S. and Colombia. In any random sample of some two dozen mid-level Colombian military veterans, it is more likely than not that some amount of U.S. training would turn up. They're not training every recruit or every private, but they are training a lot of people at that level, Isaskun said. So it's very likely they would have received us training just through sheer statistical probability, unquote. Isaskun argued the fact that the mercenaries' training was not unusual does not mean there is not reason for concern. I worry about the United States being associated with or even increasing the lethal skills of military and police units around the region that are either abusive or corrupt or undemocratic. And of course, that's always been a huge risk in Colombia, given its human rights record. So it does require a lot of scrutiny to make sure that we are not associating ourselves with or improving the lethal skills of people who end up doing what we just saw in Haiti, but also people who end up doing what we just saw in Bogota and Cali since late April, he said, referring to recent and violent crackdowns by Colombian security forces on protesters. We don't want to be associated with Americans.
On July 19, 2019, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps detained the UK-flagged oil tanker Stena Impero in the Strait of Hormuz, a channel that links the Persian Gulf with the Oman Sea and the Indian Ocean. In a statement, the IRGC said the Swedish-owned vessel had been impounded with its 23 crew members aboard at the request of the Ports and Maritime Organization of Hormuzgan Province for failing to respect international maritime rules. The British tanker had violated the maritime regulations by switching off its tracking systems. It also disregarded the established procedures by making an entry from the exit point of the Strait of Hormuz in the south instead of Northern Pass. The oil tanker was then escorted to Iran's Bandar Abbas port for further legal procedures and investigations. The head of Hormuzgan Ports and Maritime Organization said Stena Impero ignored distress calls as it collided with a fishing boat on its route.
The vessel, to avoid inspections that we must have conducted in this collision incident, changed its route. This jeopardized the safety of shipping lanes in the region and gravely violated international regulation on passage in marine areas. Accordingly, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' naval forces guided the vessel to harbor at the port city of Bandar Abbas for inspection as well as technical investigation of the circumstances, effects, and causes of the incident in accordance with international regulations.
Tensions escalated between Iran and the UK following the seizure of Stena Impero. Britain described the seizure as a dangerous act and called for the release of the vessel.
We need to see the illegal seizing of a British flagged vessel reversed. We need that ship released. And we continue to be very concerned about the safety and welfare of the 23 crew members.
However, Iran said the seizure of the British vessel was legal. It said collisions happen in the Strait of Hormuz, but regulations require those involved to respond to regional authorities' inquiries. After 2 months in detention, Iran's inquiry into the tanker's conduct was completed and a resolution to the matter was reached. Stena Impero set sail in September and left Iranian waters for Dubai, putting an end to 2 months of row. In early June, British Marines assisted Gibraltar to seize an Iranian supertanker off the southern coast of Spain. Gibraltar's officials claimed the ship was transporting crude oil to Syria in violation of EU sanctions imposed on Damascus. Moreover, Britain defended the seizure of Iran's supertanker as a legal move. Meanwhile, Washington praised the move and hailed it as a sign of Europe acting along the line of US unilateral sanctions against Tehran. However, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif slammed the detainment of Iran's tanker and described it as piracy, adding that the objective behind Iran's actions was to uphold international maritime rule. Also, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran would respond to Britain's piracy over the seizure of an Iranian oil tanker in Gibraltar.
So it's an unbelievable arrogance on the part of the Western powers, but then they've been demonstrating that for most of the 20th century and all of this century.
U.S. sanctions on Iran's oil, U.K. seizure of Iranian supertanker, and sabotage operations on oil ships are all instances of the West's actions that have caused turmoil in the international energy market. Add to this list the economic warfare waged by Israel against Iran. A Wall Street Journal report in March revealed that Israel had systematically struck at least 12 Iranian ships. However, Iran has time and again shown its adversaries that their illegal acts in the Persian Gulf will not be left unanswered.
The discovery of an unmarked graveyard at a former residential school run by the Catholic Church in the Canadian province of British Columbia in May, which contained at least 215 human remains, mostly young children, prompted an outpouring of grief and anger and a wider investigation into similar boarding schools that were open from the late 19th century to the mid-1990s. The probes have so far found some 1,100 bodies at the sites of former residential schools in the provinces of British Columbia and Saskatchewan. a Canadian researcher whose works contributed to the uncovering of the first mass grave, has said the discoveries so far have barely scratched the surface. The residential school system in Canada was established in 1883 under the country's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald. The aim was to assimilate Indigenous peoples in Canada and destroy their languages and culture. By the 1920s, attending residential schools had been made mandatory for children aged between 7 and 15.
These have been going on for years. The residential school survivors just basically were ignored. Now today, it seems a shock to some people, but it shouldn't be a shock because this was known that it was the policy in Canada. It was also the policy in the United States. They just pulled these kids out of their homes, and they wanted to indoctrinate them. And that's exactly what they tried to do.
Some 150,000 children were separated from their parents, often under threats of persecution. The first mass grave in British Columbia was found after Indigenous elders recollected the memories of young children digging holes in the ground. The survivors have told harrowing stories of how the mistreatment and abuse the children were subjected to at the former residential schools led some to attempt suicide or try to escape.
Many of our children who ran away during the winter and froze to death on their way home. And the quiets, the black robes, start lying about the children. Oh yeah, they're doing fine here. In the meantime, they were missing, and no one had searched for them.
A former student of the Cooper Island Industrial School has described the place as Canada's Alcatraz. In a 2015 report, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada called the practices employed in the former schools, quote, cultural genocide.
We're trying to say, people trying to say now, cultural genocide. It doesn't fit in the description of the word genocide as defined by the United Nations. And it's very clear that that's what they did.
These are the hard truths that are part of Canada's history. These are the hard truths we must confront as a society.
The Canadian government has vowed to fulfill the Indigenous people's demands to fund investigations into the graves around the country, but it's come under criticism for failing to do so earlier, as the discoveries made so far have been funded by the Indigenous groups themselves. The First Nations leaders say over 6,000 children died at the schools from causes like disease, accident, and suicide, but there's no clear picture of how many children lost their lives throughout the years. That means there will be more headlines about mass graves discoveries around Canada in the months to come.
The United Arab Emirates is among a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States and condemned by Palestinians. The Emiratis, who have been particularly open about their ongoing normalization process, opened an embassy in Israel this week.
The UAE has never been known for having an independent foreign policy. It has never stood for the rights of Palestinian people. Historically and recently, as you have seen, the UAE has always aligned its foreign policy with the foreign policy objectives of Western countries like the US and UK.
The new embassy is located in the heart of Israel's financial hub, Tel Aviv Stock Exchange Building. This is seen by many as a sign that the two sides are highlighting the role of economic cooperation in their normalization of ties. Last month, Israel opened an embassy in the Emirati capital Abu Dhabi and a consulate in the UAE's business hub Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals, ranging from financial services to tourism. Critics say Emirati leaders have totally abandoned the Palestinian cause for the economic and political dividends of ties with the Israeli regime. The controversial normalization process is very much ongoing, despite Palestinian anger. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stances adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinian movement Hamas says this week's embassy opening, quote, marks an insistence on the great sin against the people of Palestine and all the nations of the region. It warned that the move would encourage the regime to press ahead with its crimes in the occupied territories and in the besieged Gaza Strip. Observers warn that the embassy opening, just weeks after Israel's deadly onslaught against the Gaza Strip and the escalation of the regime's violations in the occupied West Bank, indicates that some Arab states are no longer bound by the Palestinian cause. Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel. The Palestinian issue was once a unifying cause among Arab countries. But Israel, backed by the United States, has apparently managed to divide them more than ever. Israel has been especially thankful to the United States for pushing the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan to normalize their ties with the regime. America has always been a staunch ally of Israel. But former U.S. President Donald Trump was perhaps the best friend of the Israelis in a very long time. His extremely pro-Israel decisions and policies are still impacting the lives of people in the West Asia region, especially those in Palestine. The Palestinians say they have come to the conclusion that America's heavily biased stance leaves no room for any further U.S. mediation role regarding Palestine in the future.
As protests continue in Cuba, Iran has warned against any foreign interference in its internal affairs. Tehran has urged an end to Washington's unilateral sanctions on the Caribbean nation. The Iranian Foreign Ministry also highlighted the economic hardships caused by decades of U.S. measures against Cuba, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. Iran says the U.S. is the root cause of many of the problems in Cuba. In a blatant violation of international law, Washington continues to express support for protests in Cuba and seeks to meddle in its affairs. Meanwhile, the Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez has held the U.S. responsible for stirring up violence in Cuba, saying that Washington is using high-tech digital systems to incite protests in the Caribbean island nation. Rodriguez has said that Washington sought to generate disorder and instability to fracture the constitutional order and social consensus in Cuba. He condemned the campaign promoted from U.S. soil through social media to promote riots and destabilizing acts, warning that such irresponsible conduct could have negative implications for the region and even harm the national interests of the U.S.
The United States has, since the 60s, been interfering in the internal affairs of Cuba, beginning with the Bay of Pigs. They launched not only an invasion of Cuba, but also tried to create paramilitaries there. And in doing so, they also set up a blockade, which affected the internal and the domestic economy of Cuba and had a long-lasting impact for over six decades, costing hundreds of billions of dollars.
A large-scale anti-Cuba communication operation had been underway since June 23, when Havana presented the report, Necessity of Ending the Economic, Commercial, and Financial Blockade Imposed by the United States of America on Cuba at the UN General Assembly. The operation includes calls for violence, aggression against the authorities, and the assassination of leaders.
A lot of these attempts have ended up failing, but these are all attempts to really strangle the nation and strangle really the civilians. And it's very hypocritical of the United States, who's now decrying interference from foreign countries like Russia or China, to have this history with interfering with other nations like Cuba, but also outside of Cuba throughout Latin America.
Protest rallies erupted against the Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel's government over the weekend. Thousands took to the streets in major cities, demanding his resignation amid a worsening economic crisis. The unrest comes at a time when Cuba is going through its worst economic crisis in 30 years, with chronic shortages of electricity and food, exacerbated by hefty U.S. sanctions.
There are difficult times due to circumstances, including the blockade, including the pandemic, which is already causing difficulty on the island for many of the people. And the U.S. is continuing to add to that difficulty by continuing these illegal sanctions. And again, it's not just the case for Cuba. We can go to Venezuela.
The Cuban government blames the economic woes mainly on U.S. sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. has maintained a harsh economic, financial, and commercial embargo against Cuba for more than 60 years. Numerous resolutions by the U.N. General Assembly have indicated that the blockade is against international law. The social media campaign directed against Cuba is reminiscent of many other regime change programs directed by the U.S.
It was just recently that the U.N. voted against the U.N. U.S. embargo, with only two countries voting against that resolution. That was the U.S. and Israel, while over 180 countries voted to end the illegal embargo or blockade against Cuba. Yet despite these votes, which have been occurring, you know, every few years or so, the U.S. continues with this blockade.
Including the 2019 coup d'etat against the Bolivian President Evo Morales and an attempted coup against President Maduro in Venezuela, the U.S. has recently further tightened the illegal embargo under the pretext of fighting the spread of the coronavirus. Many Cubans have grown frustrated with the economic crisis and the surge in coronavirus cases. Although the current U.S. President Joe Biden had pledged during his presidential campaign to reverse some of Trump's brutal sanctions measured against Cuba, he has yet to remove any of the sanctions imposed by the former Republican president.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The intensity and scale of the floods in Germany this week have shocked climate scientists, who did not expect records to be broken this much over such a wide area or this soon. After the deadly heat wave in the United States and Canada, where temperatures rose above 49.6 degrees Celsius 2 weeks ago, the deluge in Central Europe has raised fears that human-caused climate disruption is making extreme weather even worse than predicted. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Jonathan Watts. The piece is titled, Climate Scientists Shocked by Scale of Floods in Germany. The intensity and scale of the floods in Germany this week have shocked climate scientists, who did not expect records to be broken this much and over such a wide area or this soon. After the deadly heat wave in western United States and Canada, where temperatures rose above 49.6 degrees Celsius,